Ever wonder where those perfectly round, orangey supermarket tomatoes come from in the dead of winter? This hour, journalist Barry Esterbrook joins us to talk about his book, Tomato Land, the unsavory story of those industrially farmed fruits grown in the fields of Florida sand. They look like tomatoes, but they don't taste much like them. And we'll talk about the people who pick the tomatoes, sometimes living in modern slavery, he says. Plus, new results from the Large Hadron Collider say the Higgs boson is running out of places to hide and might not exist at all. So then what? Finally, the satellites we use to monitor Hurricane Irene and other severe storms, will cuts in NOAA's budget also cut out our views of the weather? Some answers in your questions after this break. Stay with us. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard? You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at scifry. That's at S-C-I-F-R-I. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in 2008, the renowned physicist Stephen Hawking shocked the world of physics by betting fellow physicists 50 pounds, that'd be about $100 at that time, that the Higgs boson, dubbed the God particle, would not be found when scientists cranked up the Large Hadron Collider to look for it. Well, if the findings coming out of a meeting of scientists in Mumbai hold up, Hawking may have taken a giant step toward winning that bet. The physicists said that for a large portion of the places that they thought they'd find the Higgs, it was nowhere to be found. So if it's there, the Higgs is still hiding and running out of places to hide in, leaving us just a few more places to look. Well, what if it doesn't exist at all? Is it possible that all the mathematics and the theories that have led the physicists astray, are they wrong? And this particle really just a figment of our mathematical imagination? And if so, then what? Here to be quizzed about those questions and to answer for his own prediction about finding the Higgs is Amir Axel. He is author of the forthcoming book, A Strange Wilderness, The Lives of Great Mathematicians. He's also a research fellow of the history of science at Boston University. He joins us from WBUR. Welcome back, Amir.
Great talking to you, Ira. Good to be on the show.
I got to call you on your prediction. Last time on the show, you sounded like the Higgs was a shoo-in. They just had to sift through the data and they'd find it. What do you think? What do you say now?
They fooled me.
What happened?
Should have listened to Hawking.
Did he win his bet, do you think? Or will he?
Well, you asked me to take a bet. I will bet that he will win, yes.
And now, tell us what actually is going on there.
I'll tell you why, because the news is about 145 to 466 GeV. These are places to hide for everybody. So they're energy levels. But they've actually explored the lower range from 114, which below that has been excluded by LEP, by the previous CERN accelerator. From 114 to 145 has been explored by lots of previous accelerators that have the energy to get there. And so if you look at the data from CERN, as I have, you see that there's nothing significant there. But I'll hold my word on that until they actually come out with the last bit of information on that search.
Mm. Well, the prediction that there was this God particle, which would serve as a basis for all the kind of matter we have or having mass, that was a mathematical prediction to begin with, was it not?
Absolutely. It's pure mathematics. And that's the problem with theoretical physics. It's that physics is not mathematics. In math, you prove something, you have a theorem, and its truthfulness, its validity is irrelevant. You know, it doesn't need the world. It's just a mathematical construction that is proven, while physicists try to look for different pieces of mathematics that will help him. Einstein, of course, was the greatest there. You know, he could take mathematics and make it fit into reality. And the same was, Dirac, for example, mm-hmm. with wedding quantum theory with Einstein's special theory of relativity and then using it to predict antimatter, which is a fantastic prediction. So there you use mathematics and you get predictions about the real world. But if the Higgs search fails, that means that the mathematics of the Higgs, which is certain mathematics of broken symmetries and group theory in mathematics, is not exactly right. And we have to search for other theories. And there are other theories, by the way, that go beyond the standard model. father of particle physics.
I think if Hawking was quoted back then, and I've heard other physicists say now, that they're rooting that not to find the Higgs boson. They'd like to just say, hey, you know, let's keep the search up for something.
Right. And when you talk to people at CERN, they all say, well, nature is so beautiful, it will find other things for us to show us other things. So they've been hedging their bets from the beginning. But it's no secret that the Large Hadron Collider was built mostly to look for the Higgs. And a positive result is much more powerful than a negative result. You know, some people say, well, if there's no Higgs, we'll be happy too. Well, not quite as happy.
Well, are there other theories they might, other mathematics they might fall back on to describe?
Well, one of them is Technicolor, which is a theory that was put forward by Steven Weinberg, and also some other physicists explored it further. And that's a more complicated theory at higher energies, where you break that symmetry, which is necessary for creating mass in the universe, in other ways, without the Higgs mechanism.
When did mathematics become so entwined with the physical world? It wasn't always like that, was it?
Well, the ancient Greeks invented pure mathematics and, you know, presented those great theorems and their proofs. And Galileo actually changed everything. Galileo said, the book of nature is written in the language of mathematics. And from my point of view, that started it all. Then physicists, well, Newton, of course, created or invented or discovered calculus to fit, you know, his physical laws, you know, gravitational theory. So since Galileo, we've been very close with mathematics and physics. But the point is that you don't always hit the right mathematical theory. So while mathematics explain physics very well, you have to find the right one and the right theory. And that's where it takes maybe art rather than science or mathematics. You know, you have to have the imagination, as Einstein did, and sort of have a feel for what's the right theory.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. John in Davis. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
We met once at Fermilab a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to comment on the fact that, I've been personally looking for the Higgs boson myself for almost 20 years now, and I would say though the Large Hadron Collider and the Tevatron at Fermilab are doing great work, and both are capable of discovering the particle, neither has enough data yet to say anything about a Higgs, which exists, let's say, at 120 GeV, the energy level that Amir referred to before. And though until we find it, it's still just a mathematical construct, there's every reason to believe that we very well might in the next few years. But it's going to take a lot more data and a lot more work. I wouldn't count the Higgs theory out quite yet. But even if we do find it, it may not be a single particle. It could be the first of a number of Higgs bosons waiting there to be discovered. So it's a really exciting time right now.
Amir, got a comment?
Right. The hurricane actually gives us a very good way to explain the hunt for the Higgs, how it works statistically. So I think all the listeners have probably seen those maps on television and newspapers that show the path of the hurricane. Now, the hurricane path has a band around it, like a little cone. Now, if you can imagine another as being a cone but a band around it, and that's a probability band, or what statisticians call the confidence band, then that works at 95%. Now, if you look at the data from CERN that's coming out right now, you'll see those bands. You can find them online. The bands of uncertainty at 95%, and at that level of probability at 95%, if you believe CERN, and there's no reason not to believe them, the Higgs has been excluded from 145 to 466 GeV. And if you look at the data themselves, you see that there are jumps outside, as if the hurricane in a picture comes out of this prediction band outside, either to the right or to the left, but it only happens one time in 20, which is what you expect for a 95% probability band. So nothing at 95%, I think they've concluded that the Higgs doesn't, it's not there, but there's still a 5% chance that it does exist. So a negative result is always much more problematic than a positive result. A positive result in particle physics requires what's called 5 sigma, which is a probability of 99.99997% sureness, which is fantastic. I mean, all other areas of statistics, you don't require such great confidence. So a positive result tells you that the Higgs exists, if they do that, if they find that, with a probability that is fantastic, 99.9999.7%. While a negative result just says, well, you know, we don't have enough evidence to conclude that it exists.
Thanks for calling, John. Take care. 1-800-999-8255 is our number. So they're going to be continuing to sift through the data. I mean, there are a lot of scientists there at that Mumbai conference. Are they all, they're all going away now? Happy or sad, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say. But the point is that the more data you collect, those bands change. That's the key to the search for the Higgs. So when you get more and more data, those bands shrink, and you can get higher and higher probability. That's how they can aim for a 5 sigma.
I'm running out of time, so I'm going to bunch my questions together. Amir, is it possible that the Large Hadron Collider just isn't capable of finding the Higgs? And the scientists are going to say, we need a bigger one.
Well, that's always the case. When you talk to particle physicists, they say we need bigger and bigger accelerators. But the point is that at 7 TeV, which is what they're running at now, 7 trillion electron volts, they're searching for particles that are in, say, half a trillion electron volt is the max at 466 GeV. And so they have a lot of energy there. But, of course, scientists will always want bigger accelerators. And there could be a possibility that there's a desert of particles there. There's nothing there until you reach very high energy level. So that's quite a possibility.
Mm-hmm. I made you come on last time and give us your prediction. Are you going to go out on a limb for us on this one and say it's finished?
Yeah, I'll vote with Hawking. I'll be Betsy here.
It's hard to vote against him. Though there are people, he did have other bets, didn't he? I'm trying to remember what they were. He lost one. I can't remember what it was. But he does like to bet about these things.
Right. And every time he bets, it causes this big, you know, media thing. You know, Peter Higgs got very upset that Hawking was betting against him. And so he tried to argue. And then he said that, you know, arguing with Hawking is like criticizing Prince is Diana. So
that's how big that is, huh?
Yeah.
That, if you're in the world of physics, this is like betting against Diana, or you know, or saying the Beatles song is going to be a flop or something like that sort of thing like that. So what's your new book that you're working on? Tell us about the history of mathematics.
It's about the life stories of mathematicians. You know, get all these people, including some in physics, the people who worked, with group theory and so on.
Can you be a physicist without being a mathematician these days?
That's hard. It's hard. You require a lot of mathematics. Experimentalists don't use much mathematics. Mm-hmm. And there are other areas in physics but in theoretical physics, it's when you talk to theoretical physicists and they write on the board and then you compare it with what pure mathematicians do. I have friends in both camps. Mm-hmm. And you see the same writings, you know, differential geometry and, you know, all these topology, you know, the Calabi-Yau manifold, which
My hair is hurting. thanks for coming on and talking
My
with
pleasure.
Us. Have a good weekend.
Talking to you.
Amir
Gzel
is the author of the forthcoming book, A Strange Wilderness, The Lives of the Great Mathematicians, and being a historic writer myself, I can't wait to read this one. He's also a research fellow of the history of science at Boston University. Stay with us. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about tomatoes. Tomato land. You're never going to look at a tomato the same way again. Let me put it that way, and we'll tell you why when we come back, so stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What part of your salad looks the most colorful and delicious, but really has the least flavor? I'm betting it's your tomato. But you already knew that because tomatoes, unless you buy them locally, are always a disappointment. I never really understood the full extent of the reasons why until I read the book written by my next guest, who has made me question every tomato I see from now on. And he has raised some serious questions about how they are grown and picked and what amounts to what he calls slave labor, real slave labor still going on in Florida. Barry Estabrook is the author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. He joins us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Welcome to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for having me.
What a story you tell here. I mean, and you begin in a wonderful way by telling the story of a truck you were following on a highway in which you thought Granny Smith apples were falling at him.
Yeah, it was in southwestern Florida a few years ago, and I was minding my own business, cruising along, and I saw this open-back truck. It looked like it was loaded, as you said, with green apples. And then I thought to myself, apples don't grow in Florida. And as I pulled up behind it, I saw they were tomatoes, a whole truckload mounded over with perfectly green tomatoes, not a shade of pink or red in sight. As we were going along, we came to a construction site. The truck hit a bump, and three or four of these things flew off the truck. They narrowly missed my windshield, but they did hit the pavement. They bounced a few times, and then they rolled onto the shoulder. None of them splattered. None of them even showed cracks. I mean, a modern-day industrial tomato has no problem with falling off a truck at 60 miles an hour on an interstate highway.
Not to mention what it must taste like, besides how it's made and it's indestructible. And that started you along the road to investigating how tomatoes are really made and how they're grown.
Well, I wondered how you take this fruit that we get this time of year in the farmer's market or from our gardens. And it's very difficult to get a tomato from my garden, the 25 yards to my kitchen counter, without it spontaneously splitting. And how do you get from something as wonderful as that to these potentially lethal projectiles?
And what you discovered is that first, which is most astounding to me when I read it, is that tomatoes are not supposed to grow in Florida. That's not their natural habitat. And second, in Florida where they're growing in sort of pure sand. There's no soil.
Well, exactly. It's counterintuitive, I know. I mean, the Sunshine State, and it's warm, but it's also extremely humid. It's extremely humid year-round, and everything that loves to prey on a tomato, every fungus, every bacteria, every rust, mold, germ, every insect, loves humidity.
Right.
Tomatoes hate humidity. Their wild ancestors live on the along the coastal regions of South America, and that's some of the driest deserts in the world. And it's why tomatoes do well in places like California and Italy. They love these dry summer days. Florida's humid. That's step one. You're right. And the second thing is, most Florida commercial tomatoes are growing in sand. It's not sandy loam. It's not sandy soil. It's sand, just like you get on Daytona Beach, and it's got the same level of nutrients. Everything that plant needs to survive, to grow, has to be injected into that sand, or you'd get nothing.
Wow. And so you wind up with this perfectly formed green tomato that is not being grown for its taste, but its indestructibility, as you demonstrated on that highway. And then how does it get turned into something we see in our grocers?
Well, these tomatoes are picked by hand, slicing tomatoes, fresh tomatoes that you buy whole as opposed to canned tomatoes are picked by hand. They have to be. They are loaded into one of these vast, huge trucks like the one that nearly did me in, and they're trucked to warehouse-like processing plants where they're washed, waxed, put in cartons, and then the cartons are placed on pallets. And these bright green tomatoes go into warehouse-like buildings where the doors are closed, and the processors turn on ethylene gas, and the tomatoes are gas. Now, ethylene will cause a tomato to turn red. It's actually emitted naturally by the plants in the fields when they want to ripen their fruits. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's artificial, and even if a tomato is not ripe, it obligingly turns red.
Wow. And you outline in your book something I have never heard since I watched The Grapes of Wrath on television recently, that there are foreign workers who are brought in and they are made to be virtual slaves to pick these tomatoes.
I'm going to have to take a little bit of an issue with you. Virtual is not a qualifier I would use. Let me run down a couple of quick details. Locked up, shackled in chains at night. locked in the back of produce trucks at night so that they're handy to be delivered to the fields in the morning, bought and sold and negotiated for almost at auction.
Tell the story of the Guatemalan worker as an example.
All right. He was a guy who came up here from Guatemala. His folks in Guatemala were both sick. The family had no money. So he took the usual route, came across the border, found his way to this town of Immokalee in southwestern Florida. It's sort of tomato capital during the wintertime. And he was out of work and broke and sort of waiting for something to come along and was sitting on a bench with a few other guys. And this fellow pulls up in a pickup truck and he says, "Anyone want work?" And the Guatemalan fellow said, "I do." And the guy said, "Great, come on aboard. I pay twice the going rate per bucket of tomatoes. If you don't have a place to stay, we will happily put you up at our place. My mom cooks for our crew. She charges you a bit of money, but she'll cook for you." He thought, wow. He pretty soon realized that, he was put in the back of a produce truck. That was his room and board, and he got charged $50 a week. The food was atrocious, often just dry tortillas. That was $50 a week. Everything came with an exorbitant imaginary price tag. To stand under a cold hose at the end of a day's work was $5. And lo and behold, he found that no matter how hard he worked, he kept falling further and further behind. And he saw what if people didn't work, they were beaten. Some were hospitalized. They were told that they were now property of this crew leader and his cohorts. And for 2.5 years, this particular guy worked as a slave. Occasionally, they'd give him a $20 bill to keep his hopes up, but there was no regular pay, and he couldn't leave. He had no choice of when he worked.
What do you mean he couldn't leave?
Well, as he pointed out, one of his crew finally just couldn't take it anymore and ran away, and one of the crew boss guys chased him in the pickup truck and came back an hour or so later, and the guy was beaten to the point where he was unrecognizable and had to be dropped off at the hospital, and it was he's permanently injured. He survived, but permanently injured. And the crew boss said, "You want to try to run away from me? Take a look."
Is this still going on?
Sadly, it's still going on. This is not an isolated case. There have been more than 1,200 people freed from slavery rings in Florida agriculture in the last 10 or 15 years. Off the record, an official told me recently that there's two cases currently under investigation. The problem is they're very, very hard cases to prosecute. So what you're seeing is the tip of a really ugly iceberg.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of the tomatoes in supermarkets come from Florida?
Depends on the time of year. Right now, none. But during certain periods of the winter, virtually all the tomatoes that you'll see in the supermarket or get in a fast food restaurant or a sandwich shop will come from Florida. Mm-hmm. Overall, mm-hmm. Florida produces about a third of the fresh tomatoes we eat in the United States.
You mentioned how in your book how California and Florida produce equal amounts of tomatoes, but Florida uses 8 times the pesticides as California.
Yes, for fresh tomatoes. It's astounding. And that's because of what we talked about earlier. The weather, the climate, right, is just not right in Florida to grow tomatoes. So they have to wage what amounts to chemical warfare. There's 110 different chemicals in the official Florida guidebook for commercial tomato growers that you can spray on a field over the course of the few months that those tomatoes are in the field, including many that the EPA rates as acutely toxic, which means they can kill you.
And the workers are exposed to this also, I imagine.
You know, I probably talked to 3 or 4 dozen workers personally researching the book, and I'd ask that question. I said, "Have you ever been sprayed?" And they'd look at me as if I said, do you put your pants on in the morning?" They said, "Of course, all the time." I said, "To like your clothes are wet?" I said, "Soaked." And then the vines are wet if we're not being sprayed directly. So pesticides on workers is a horrific problem. They just spray, it seems, with abandon, even though it's illegal.
All right, let me go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Craig in Fort Myers, Florida. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call. One very brief comment and then another comment. One is that the fast food industry is the designer of these tomatoes. They want tomatoes that are hard and easily sliced thinly. And a huge percentage of these tomatoes go to the fast food industry. And then my other comment is about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is an organization, a not-for-profit organization made up mostly of tomato pickers here in southern Florida, that works, one, to expose the slavery that goes on among agricultural workers here in southwestern Florida, and then also runs boycotts against agencies to try to raise the pay for workers down here. And we've had successful boycotts against most of the fast food restaurants, and we're currently organizing a protest against public supermarkets.
Well, you know, reading Tomatoland, Barry Estabrook's book, it's hard to imagine that this really goes on, but you can testify to the fact also.
Oh, I've been working in this field for 12 years now. And it goes on all the time, and the conditions for workers are horrific. And we can't leave out the packing companies. They're complicit in all of this. And the living conditions, even when they're not shackled, which I know that they are, living conditions, it's not unusual to have 10, 15, 20 workers living in a broken-down mobile home, each of them paying $200 a month in rent.
And this is taken out before this Sorry? Is taken out before they even get paid, so this is deducted from...
Well, perhaps. In some cases, yes. And in other cases, no, because there's very few landlords. Well, let me put it this differently. Most of the rental living spaces in and around the tomato fields are owned by a handful of people, often by the packing companies. Mm-hmm. So even if it's, quote-unquote, you know, not on the in the fields, you know, they're paying $2,000 a month rent for a broken-down mobile home, which you can hopefully get 15 or 20 people into.
All right, Craig.
And I can go on and on,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Interesting stuff, Barry. It jives with what you're saying in your book.
Okay. Well, yes. I mean, and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which Craig referred to, it started out as a ragtag crew of workers who just meet in a church basement, and often they just get 10 guys together to dun a reluctant crew boss who may be slow-paying some of his workers. Now they're a very formidable force that has won tremendous victories for the workers. They've completely turned around the way the companies relate to workers. Just in the last year, in fact, this fall, the tomato industry could look very different. There's a way to solve a lot of the problems mm-hmm. that we talked about. The machinery is in place. How it gets used, we'll see in the coming months.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Barry Estabrook, author of Tomato Land: How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with we thought we would start out talking about the magnificence of tomatoes, and you had no idea that you would find any of this either, I'm sure, Barry.
Well, I was a food writer,
yeah.
And had been covering the flavor issue for years, but to be honest, the workers were invisible to me. And I think that's telltale of food journalism in general at that time. It was only when these slavery cases started getting made public that I realized, wait, the problem goes way beyond a not particularly good tasting winter tomato. There's a real deep problem here.
Okay.
With the way we grow these things.
Is it changing? Do you see any change? I mean, this is the 21st century.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers has implemented a fair food agreement, which gets more money to the workers, in some basic education issues, some basic grievance procedures, some startling innovations like something called the punch clock, mm-hmm. which didn't exist before in the tomato business. Another startling thing, little tents so you can get a bit of shade in these fields for your breaks or lunch or if you get fatigued. So, you know, progress has been made, but it is still probably the crummiest job you can get in the United States legally.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the few minutes we have left, let's talk a little bit about tomatoes themselves. I mean, you're a flavor reviewer, a food reviewer. The tomato flavor is unique in itself, is it not?
You know, a tomato flavor is so complex. It's almost like a fine wine when you think about it. For example, if you were a plant breeder wanting to breed a banana for whatever reason, if you got one signature chemical into your new breed of banana, everyone would taste it and recognize it as a pretty good banana. Same with strawberries, one chemical. With tomatoes, there's a balance of citric acid, malic acid, and fructose, and then there's probably 19 or 20 different aromatic chemicals you can smell, which means chemicals you can taste, that have to go in there, and none of them bear any resemblance to a tomato. I've sat in a laboratory at the University of Florida. You'll smell roses, juicy fruit gum, cut grass. But when they're mixed together, you get that unique tomato taste. So that's what makes it so hard to breed for a tasty tomato.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Barry Estabrook, author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back, talk a little bit more with Barry, and take your questions. And 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Tell us what you like about tomatoes or don't like. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Barry Estabrook, author of Tomato Land, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. On the phone with us right now is Luis Sidibaca of the State Department. He's Ambassador at Large, Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here.
What is the State Department doing to combat this trafficking in humans?
Well, one of the things that's important for the Obama administration is to make sure that if we're looking at food, just as what we've seen with what Mr. Easterbrook did in his book, is that food security is not simply having enough or having stuff that tastes good or gets to the market. No food can truly be secure if the people that picked it were enslaved when they were doing it. So we're trying to get the word out. We're ranking other countries on how they're doing, and for the first time, we've actually been shining the light on the situation here in the United States. And unfortunately, as he found in his book, there still is modern slavery right here in our own backyards.
Mm-hmm. And can the State Department do anything about it?
Well, one of the things that we're doing, Secretary Clinton is the chair of the Interagency Cabinet Task Force, and we've stepped up enforcement around the country with new task forces at the U.S. Attorney's offices. But even more, I think that you'll be seeing us do some work in the next year to try to help consumers be able to look at their own, for lack of a better word, slavery footprint, much like you can look at your carbon footprint. But right now, you can't really necessarily tell, are these tomatoes, is this cocoa, are these fish that I'm eating? What is my own slavery footprint when I'm looking at this as a consumer?
So if I'm buying a tomato, I can know if it's made by slaves or not.
Well, and I think that, one of the things is that the organizations like the Coalition of Mockley Workers and others have helped get the companies to care. But the companies won't necessarily care about their supply chain until they know that the consumers care about their supply chain. So it's not just insisting that it can pack and it can go a long way, but it was also picked and packed in a humane and respectful manner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sidibaca, for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Luis Sidibaca of the U.S. Department of State office. He's an ambassador at large at the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Person. With me also, as I say, is Barry Estabrook, author of Tomato Land. Barry, have you talked to them before? Any reaction?
I haven't talked to the State Department, but I have talked to many law enforcement officers in southwestern Florida who've been direct the front lines in these slavery prosecutions. And I have to say, refreshingly forthcoming. As a reporter, often lawyers and policemen are, closed mouth. These guys, I have the feeling that they take their job personally. It's a horrific crime. You know, all these people do is want to come and work. They're willing to do, you know, they're desperate and they want to work. They don't want to panhandle. They want to work, and they end up as slaves. And so tremendous cooperation from Douglas Malloy, who's the U.S. attorney for that district of Florida, mm-hmm. tremendous cooperation from the Collier County, Florida Police Department, Charlie Frost down there, unprecedented. Because this is a type of crime, they all tell me, that withers in the light of publicity. It can't stand it. No one wants to have conditions that existed in 1850 happening right now, you know, in Florida or anywhere in the United States.
Well, Barry, maybe your book Tomato Land becomes the new Grapes of Wrath. So we wish, you know, you and Steinbeck, we wish you good luck. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Tomato Land, it will change the way you look at tomatoes, written by Barry Esterbrook, How Modern Industrial Agriculture Destroyed Our Most Alluring Fruit. It's been a record-setting year for disasters in the U.S. There was a snowmageddon in the Northeast this winter, a huge number of deadly tornadoes in the spring. We had fires and drought and heat waves in the Southwest, record flooding on the Mississippi. And recently, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that so far, we've had 9 disasters totaling over $1 billion in damages each. That makes the total bill about $35 billion in damage. And we have barely scratched the hurricane season. Irene is headed up to wreak more havoc. Who knows how much damage we might see from hurricanes before this year is out. How do we track all of these disasters? Well, for a lot of them, we rely on satellites. But Congress has already slashed NOAA's budget, threatening the future of a pair of satellites that do precisely this sort of severe weather monitoring, helping us predict the strength of blizzards and tornadoes. So does this make any sense? Don't we need to keep tabs on impending weather disasters to know whom to evacuate and when? Joining me to talk about this is David Biello. He is an associate editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American here in New York. He's in our New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
What kind of budget cutting are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about the same kind of general austerity that we've seen throughout the U.S. government. As you may have noticed,
there's been
a standoff across the board. And this is budget cutting not just for NOAA, but also for NASA. And this is an across-the-board cut in all of our Earth monitoring systems. And this is actually something that's been going on for about a decade now.
So NASA has satellites that look down on Earth, and they help us watch these different events, tornadoes and hurricanes and things?
Correct. We have two kinds of weather satellites. There are the ones that sit in what's called geostationary orbit. That means that they kind of sit there and take a picture of one hemisphere at a time. That gives you some information. And then we have these polar orbiting satellites. They go the opposite way. So they're kind of passing over the Earth while it's rotating past them underneath. And they give you a much more precise and detailed look at kind of rainfall and the other things we might like to know. Like, for example, it's how we know that Irene is probably going to dump about 8 inches of rainfall across the entire East Coast.
So the budget cuts would affect NASA and NOAA.
Correct. And like I said, this is something that's been going on for a long time. We have decided, I guess, as a government to abandon Earth observation in favor of things like Mars observation. And I would argue that perhaps we ought to pay more attention to our home rather than our neighbors.
Well, we had an earthquake and a hurricane in the same sort of week here. I think people might wake up a little bit on Capitol Hill.
I would hope so. I mean, I'm assuming that they're using these satellite forecasts to mm-hmm. kind of plan their own travel, perhaps plan their own evacuation, perhaps batten down the hatches on their summer home. And I would think they would come to appreciate what could be lost. Now, this isn't something that's going to happen tomorrow. This is something that's going to happen over, say, the course of the next decade. NASA is launching in October. One of these satellites that would do this polar orbit that's so mm-hmm. critical to kind of weather prediction. The problem is in more like 2016, 2018, the satellites that would be the successor to that program and continue and make sure that we continue our kind of eyes in the sky on that stuff would be the ones that were lost.
And so there's no money for that now?
There's no money for that, and so they're going to have to delay those by up to 2 years, the launch, in the hopes that some money would come later.
So we'll have a satellite gap.
Exactly. And we already have a satellite gap for certain things. There was a satellite called ICESat. As its name applies, it was keeping tabs on kind of the meltdown in Antarctica. Unfortunately, it reached the end of its design life and shut down. And there was no replacement because, like I said, during the Bush administration, we cut the money. We stopped putting these kinds of satellites up. And they've now replaced that with a plane. For weather observation.
A plane.
Yes, an airplane flying through.
Hope it flies fast.
Yeah, flying through polar weather. That's not ideal conditions, as you can imagine.
Yes, I've been there.
And the only possible replacement for these weather satellites are weather balloons. So, again, we'd be going
back to the future.
It's back to 1850 again. Yeah, so it's, there's no good answer for this because we have fallen so far behind on our Earth observations. I think there are about 15 satellite systems, including this this weather one. 14 out of the 15 are past their design life and will shut down shortly, and they will not be replaced. You might be familiar with Landsat, which has given this huge data set over many, many years. The latest iteration of that is reaching the end of its life and may or may not be replaced. One of the things that is kind of overlooked in this is that it's very difficult to match up data sets, between different satellite programs. So you kind of want that continuity so that you know that you're measuring always the same thing. That helps with things like climate change that are perhaps politically sensitive.
Is that one of the reasons they did away with – or not – I shouldn't say do away. They're not going to fund a new satellite, that they don't want climate change to be part of this?
Certainly that has been the first thing to go each and every time this has happened. So, for example, this satellite going up in October used to be planned to have this whole array of sensors that were going to tell us a lot about climate change. Those are all gone for budget cuts. So it's only going to do the weather.
So they in the allocation, it says no
it's
sensing
not that the,
for climate.
Yeah, no, it's not that the allocation. It's that we're only going to give you, say, $1 million, but in order to have the climate sensors, we need $2 million. So what do you do?
Well, it's
you cut
not
the climate sensors.
It's not changing. Why do we need?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Why do we need it? Could other nations help us fill in the gap in this satellite?
Other nations actually already are helping to fill in the gap. First of all, the military is helping fill in the gap. They have military weather satellites that are doing this polar orbiting. Because obviously the military has a vested interest
absolutely.
In knowing what the weather's going to be.
I think so.
The Europeans also have some, and they help us with some of the rest of the day. But we're the only ones who are doing kind of the late afternoon to evening shift with these weather satellites, and we will just lose that information.
Well, the Chinese own a lot of our debt. Why don't we have them help us fill in the satellite gap?
I know. We owe them a lot of money.
They should invest some of that back in the satellite.
Unfortunately, there is actually a law now that was just passed that NASA is not allowed by law to participate in any joint ventures with China whatsoever. So that won't be happening anytime soon. Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. That should be
no joint ventures between NASA and China.
Correct. So we're limited
even
to the Europeans.
Even if I wanted a common tour of the country, I mean, I couldn't bring them over on a joint venture.
Well, not if you're NASA.
I wanted to take them to Times Square. I couldn't. Wow.
Not for NASA.
Not for NASA.
Yeah.
It used to be with the Russians. Now we're talking about the Chinese.
It's definitely very, very Cold War.
Wow. And so we have this gap coming up that we might be without these satellites for a while. And do you think this could change as an observer? Do you think this focus that we shine some light on this might change?
It will be a momentary light based on past experience. Once Irene kind of blows over, people will relatively quickly forget why we spend a relatively small amount of money on satellites so we can know about Hurricane Irene before it hits us. I mean, we have 36 hours to prepare, right?
Right.
That's thanks to satellites.
All right. You've summed that up, David. Thank you very, very much. David Biello is an associate editor for Environment and Energy at Scientific American here in New York. And wishing you a safe weekend.
Same to you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Time now for our monthly episode of Science Diction, where we talk about the origins of scientific words with my guest Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. They should combine those names, make it easier to say. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
How are you? What's our word today?
Well, the word today is chemistry.
We have chemistry.
We have,
you and I have some chemistry.
We do. There's a lot of argument. We've all taken chemistry in high school, and some of us have even taken it in college. But there's a great deal of controversy. Did it come from ancient Egypt or from ancient Greece? Now, some have claimed that there's an Egyptian origin. Back in 300 AD, a Roman emperor, Diocletian, decreed that the burning of all Egyptian writings that outlined the transmutation of gold into silver. Mm. And based on this edict, as well as several hieroglyphic inscriptions, people such as Plutarch in 100 AD insisted that the root word chem was derived from the name of ancient Egypt, which was called the land of chem, or alchemia. And that really means rich black soil, the type of soil that flourished near the banks of the Nile and was prized for its fertility as opposed to the sands of the surrounding desert. But the Oxford English Dictionary, on the other hand, declares that the word is more likely the child of Greek roots, chemia, which means pouring or infusion. And the ancient Greeks applied this term to what we would call pharmaceutical chemistry. The physicians would extract juices or infusions of plants for medicinal purposes. Now, for many centuries, chemistry and alchemy were practically interchangeable for Egyptians, Persians, Greeks, Romans, and later Europeans, well into the 16th century. And the goal was to discover or create a mythical philosopher's stone that could turn base metals into gold and silver, and also act as an elixir that would magically cure all of one's ills and grant us eternal youth. But there was also a wonderful set of philosophies attached to alchemy that would concern your own transformation into a virtuous person, and that continued all the way into the psychoanalytical writings of Carl Jung. I should mention, by the way, that the original Harry Potter book, the first one in keeping with its alchemical theme, was called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. But despite its runaway success in Great Britain, the U.S. publisher changed it to Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone because they believed that no American child would buy a book containing the word philosopher.
Heavens forbid.
But later on, in the 17th century on, a great many natural philosophers and alchemists, including Robert Boyle, began to rethink the field, and they wanted to apply physical methods to study matter. And in fact, Robert Boyle wrote a 1661 treatise called The Skeptical Chemist, and he renamed the field chemistry. And he's known for a lot of things, best known for Boyle's law, right, the inversely proportional relationship between the absolute pressure and volume of a gas. And as the centuries proceeded, there was a whole host of scientific revolutionaries, you know, Lavoisier, John Dalton, and many others, and they developed what we know now as modern chemistry, which is a quantitative and reproducible framework for understanding not only the composition of matter, but also how matter can change forms by means of chemical reactions. So it's been some time since we've discarded the teachings of alchemy and the philosopher's stone and all that wonderful mysticism about transforming not only lead into gold, but ourselves, unless that is you're a graduate of the prestigious Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. It's still taught there, I'm told.
Well, Howard, you know how to sum the whole thing up very, very well and bring it up today. Thank you very much. Fascinating history.
Well, thanks for having me.
And have a good weekend to you.
You too. Have a safe one.
Yeah, we'll do the best we can. Thanks a lot, Howard.
Okay.